This is from The Gateless Gate. Mind is Buddha, the main case. Tame once asked Master Matsu, "What is Buddha?" And Matsu answered, "Mind is Buddha." Woman's commentary. If you can at once grasp it, you're wearing Buddha clothes, eating Buddha food, speaking Buddha words, and living Buddha life. You're a Buddha yourself. Though this may be so, Tame has misled a number of people and let them trust a scale with a stuck pointer. Don't you know that one has to rinse out their mouth for 3 days if they've uttered the word Buddha? If you're a true practitioner, you'll stop your ears and rush away when you hear mind is Buddha. The poem. A fine day under the blue sky. Don't foolishly look here and there. If you still ask, what is Buddha? It's like pleading your innocence while clutching stolen goods. Good morning. Hope you're all enjoying yourself so far. Enjoying yourself may not mean having fun. It doesn't exclude struggle. I think of it as knowing that you're where you should be on every level, and that what you're facing is mind is Buddha. And that when we trust the way, when we trust the practice and the Dharma, then even when it's difficult, even when you may feel confused, it's not true confusion. When you feel lost, it's not actually being lost. Those states, I think, come from having a very firm grasp on something. But rather, when we're practicing out of faith, then those are just natural occurrences, states you pass through on the way to living a Buddha life. And it can really help to hold, it can help us to hold ourselves in such moments and have patience and spirit. A master once asked, I had a whole different plan for this week, actually. The talk that I'm going to give tomorrow was, I had written for Fusatsu, but when I started to give the Fusatsu, I made just a couple of comments and then decided that's what I wanted to talk about. And so I had a different talk lined up for tomorrow, which was No Mind, No Buddha. But save that for another day. But in the commentary, a master says that mind is Buddha is to help the baby stop crying. And that once the baby has stopped crying, then no mind, no Buddha. And I've always liked that comment. So what is Buddha? This student is asking Master Matsu, what is Buddha? What is this question asking? You know, in the literature, and particularly in the Zen tradition, these questions can seem like kind of stock questions. You know, why did Bodhidharma come from the West? But they had meaning. I mean, they might have been used as a stock question, as just a way to get something going or to get started or not knowing what else to say. But they had purpose, they had meaning, right? And so what is Buddha? It shouldn't be an abstract question for us as practitioners of the Buddha way. Buddha, we all learn when we encounter the practices, means the awakened one, right? It actually refers to one who is awakened. So Shakyamuni, the person, became Buddha in his own awakening. And he was just in the teachings of Buddhism was just that current Buddha in a long line of Buddhas before and those that will come later. And so what is Buddha means awakened one. We can think of Buddha as miraculous awareness, as Bodhidharma speaks of it. We can think of being free of hindrances, of great compassion, of seeing into the nature of cause and effect, understanding karma. Buddha is no suffering, serenity, being free of all dualities. We can think of Buddha as within emptiness, nothingness, forsaken. What is Buddha? And all of this, oh, there we go. And all of this is occurring on a continuum. And so, you know, we shouldn't underestimate the power of our dualistic thinking and how permeating that is in our consciousness, that's our way of seeing things, and mostly in ways that we're not aware of. And so that when we encounter this way of speaking of Buddha, thinking dualistically, we can think, okay, I either am that or I'm not that. I'm not that, so I'm sunk. But the practice and the way is a continuum. It's not a fixed thing. It's not a place. Ultimately, there's no beginning. There certainly isn't any end. And so then if you think of yourself as just being on that path, and that's why path is such an important metaphor, important reality for us to be practicing within, because we all have that sense of having traveled, usually to some destination. So that's what you have to let go of, even this being a path of enlightenment, that is not a destination. You know, it's like when my mother was teaching me how to swim, and she would stand, 8 feet away. I would hold on to the edge of the pool, and she would say, "Come on, I'm holding a peanut butter and jelly sandwich." That's what she would say, right? And so that would let, and I, you know, obviously she wasn't, but I knew what she meant. So I let go and I started swimming, and then she would start backing up, right? I was like, "Wait a minute." Because she wanted me to learn how to swim, not just reach that destination, right? And so when we understand that it is a continuum, then we can hear these words not as an absolute, not as a kind of referendum, am I that or am I not? But that we are on this continuum of awakening, of engaging, entering into more and more miraculous awareness, of freeing ourselves of hindrances, of cultivating great compassion. And so whether you think you are or experience yourself as being, very sort of incipient in that, it's very much in the beginning of that or further along, in a way it's just, your current sense of things. It may or may not be more or less true. But regardless, that we're just somewhere along that continuum. And we can look back and see how we have traveled, right? That things are not the same. And we can then look forward with confidence and think, well, there's no reason to think with confidence that that's just not going to continue to happen if I continue. And so then we don't have to be afraid to aspire to Buddha, to aspire to great awakening. We also don't have to get stuck in the realities of this moment as some sort of finality or some sort of absolute state. Mind is Buddha. What is Buddha? Matsu says, mind is Buddha. And so, of course, we need to understand that mind is not your brain. It's not in your head. It's not thoughts. It's not a physical object. But at the same time, we shouldn't exclude any of that from mind. Dogen says, without practice, the Buddha way can't be attained. Without study, it remains remote. To study with mind means to study with the various aspects of mind, such as your consciousness, emotions, and intellect. Nothing is left out. And so while so much of the teachings, particularly the early teachings, talk about emotion and intellect as being obstacles, right? And oftentimes they appear as obstacles because we get embroiled in them, particularly negative emotions or negative thinking or strongly held to beliefs and ideas. And so in that way, they act as obstacles. And we think that the obstacle is in the emotion or in the idea or in the thought, but it's not actually. It's in the grasping, which is why moment to moment, everyday mind in this world and all worlds is the practice of being in accord with the way, which means not grasping. And so everything is, in a sense, as a practitioner, is always moving towards the recognition of and the release of that which we're grasping. And sometimes that happens in a moment because it's very simple, and sometimes it happens over years because it's deep. But it's always moving towards that. That's what we have to keep remembering so we don't get stuck in, you know, it's sort of like when you're on a, you know, you're driving through the mountains and there's a lookout, right? And you pull over and you go to look out and it's, you know, there's a view. And, you know, if it's a nice view, you might forget that you're actually on a trip. And so it's like we can get stuck in these lookouts, right? Because sometimes we, you know, as we are on that path, that continuum of awakening, of opening, of releasing, of seeing, we get a little enchanted with those changes, with those shifts, with those revelations, if you will. And really, they're just natural occurrences, and also it's good to be encouraged to gain confidence and faith and understanding, but to keep going. And so what Dogen is saying is that your thinking, your seeing, your hearing, your touching, your emotions, your dreams, your ideas, beliefs, that there is a study of that mind in your awareness, in your alertness, in your cognition, in your consciousness, in your thinking, and in your not thinking. He says, now mountains, rivers, earth, the sun, the moon, the stars are all mind. At just this moment, what is it that appears directly in front of you? And so the universe itself, all of these great bodies, these great beings, the rivers, earth, moon, stars, is a vivid display of non-abiding. It's not just as they appear. They are not just as they appear, nor are they otherwise. They're able to shine in the midst of darkness. They're also able to be dark in the midst of illumination. At just this moment, what is it? Our senses, you know, function so powerfully within our consciousness that, you know, other realms of existence from a Buddhist perspective, well, some realms, for instance, like the animal realm, is characterized by just taking everything as it appears to us and just acting on the basis of that. But we already come to practice having imagination, having conceived of things that are not actually in front of us, having experiencing sensed things as real, as having some kind of reality, but we couldn't prove it, right? Sometimes had trouble explaining it. And so there are these sort of glancing, these passes that we have with something that is beyond just what we can experience with our sense organs. Dukkha, the Buddha said, is in essence always seeking that which is not directly in front of us. Right? There's something here, but it's not what we had in mind. We had something else in mind because that something else is going to give us the thing we need. This isn't. This isn't going to do that. And so we reject this and we go looking for that thing. And the Buddha said, you will never succeed. And it's not your fault. Right? And you're not the first. It's not in the nature of things to succeed in that way. Succeed in the sense of obtaining what we want, which is ultimately to be whole. And so to always be seeking that which is not directly in front of me, something else. And so that anxiety, right, of being, which of course is what it's based in, because ultimately it's not just that I want this, or I want a sensation, or I want some sort of passing pleasure. I want a sense of me. I want a sense of how I am in this world, and what is the world in relationship to me. That's why Buddhism believes that, you know, when we understand human nature, we see that we are fundamentally what we might call spiritual beings, which, you know, is a little bit of a dodgy way of expressing it, because that can mean so many things. What does that mean? That fundamentally, we are of the nature to want to understand our existence. And not just as a theoretical, you know, venture, but so that we can live out of that understanding and be at peace. And what's at the core of it is our sense of identity. That's what we call delusion. That's the basis of delusion. Is it the source, the core, you know, the vault that has locked away our peace of mind or our ultimate equanimity, serenity, that what's in that vault is having unlocked the problem of identity. We don't normally think in that way because we're just functioning on the level of, you know, wanting and not wanting. But if we really look deeper and deeper and deeper, but what is the basis of this wanting? It's that sense of being. And not just being as a, you know, a castaway, an isolated, you know, sort of piece of the universe, but an ultimate sense of in a sense, belonging, right? Of place, of contact, of connection, right? An ultimate sense of identity in the sense of not two, not separate. And so the Buddha framed that in terms of this sort of mantra that arises out of that state, that sort of upside down state, way of seeing things, and that we're constantly looking at things in terms of I am this, and this is our seeking that which I am, that which is me, and that which I can possess. And then in a sense, we're constantly reducing things down to that basis. Not just because we're inherently selfish, but because fundamentally we want to be free of that. But it just gets all turned around. And so because of that, we in a sense have to constantly be trying to avoid those things that are going to threaten that. And so to stop and see. You know, that's why you know, Buddhism is so threatening in a way, fundamentally, so threatening to the teachings, the practice is so challenging, so threatening to that sense of self. And so when we, you know, as a society or as a Sangha, you know, address these manifestations of that, right? Like as in, you know, patriarchy, as in racism, as in sexism, as in, you know, the notion of white supremacy, that being white, being male, is inherently better. That these are so, we're so indoctrinated in these beliefs, in these views, that when we take up that work, why is that work so hard? You know, I was talking to Greg Snyder, I had lunch with him, he's at the Brooklyn Zen Center, and we were talking about this, and I said, you know, I think this work in certain ways has been so much harder, so much more painful than sort of confronting the self, you know, within sort of the Dharma field. And that sense of threat is, you know, within that threat, we, you know, we lose our equilibrium. And so we go looking for our equilibrium, which is, you know, why we can so often respond defensively or rationally or argumentatively to try and restore that sense. And we can do the same thing just in terms of meeting our own mind, our attachments, to just try and restore that sense of stability, but it's not stable. That sense of security, but it's not secure. And so this radical practice of meeting not in hatred and not in infatuation, not in belief, and not in trying to destroy that belief, not trying to eradicate or preserve, because that would just be denying our basic nature. Mind is Buddha. And so when it's difficult to develop the capacity to tolerate that difficulty, and sometimes that's a slight difficulty, and so it's just kind of holding it lightly, being patient. Sometimes it's an extreme difficulty. It's extremely uncomfortable. And so there, the notion of forbearance, even endurance, you know, not waiting to be delivered, but just to hold yourself within that degree of discomfort, but skillfully, right? Not just gritting and you know, closing your eyes and waiting for something to end, but with your eyes open, seeing, and having some understanding of what's happening, of what I'm facing in that moment. And then when it's delightful, to tolerate the impermanence of that delight. Right? To be able to tolerate the ephemeral nature of that which is so delightful, that I can't own it. Why? To stop the baby from crying. So if we're the baby and we need to want to stop our suffering or crying, what's the first thing we have to do? Learn how to do. Cry. So in order to alleviate our suffering, we have to learn how to suffer. But to how to suffer in a different way, in such a way that we're not perpetuating, compounding, increasing. You know, if we included that as part of beginning instruction, so what we're going to do is we're going to teach you how to suffer. It's like, no thank you. Right, we just want to run past that. But isn't that, I mean, if you really think about it, isn't that actually what we're learning how to do? And in developing that capacity, it's not the same. It's not that suffering that it was before when we didn't know how yet to do that. And so first we have to learn how to cry. The first step towards freedom from that, to feel the wound, to feel the pain. And of course, you know, those are just words. It's easy to say that. And for some, you know, who, because we've all, you know, experienced pain, everyone has experienced pain. Everyone has been hurt. But some more than others. Such that even to talk about this can sound just like madness. Can seem like a kind of toleration of what should not be tolerated. Hatred, oppression, injustice. But that's not what's being said. Right? And so that's where having faith and patience and practicing the, quote, small stuff. You know, that's why in Zazen, in practice, when, you know, there's sort of petty or small, lighter forms of suffering, practice them. Practice them well. Because what you're learning in those moments is what you're going to draw upon when what you're facing is something much more difficult. And for some, the moment you sit, what's much more difficult may be the, what appears before you. And so then there's a greater challenge, right? But remember this continuum. It's a continuum, right? That's what we're so, you know, bound by is this paradigm of success or failure. If you're not succeeding, then you're failing. If you don't have it, then you don't have it. And that's just not true. And so, in a very real sense, we have to move slowly, right? Like a baby, you know? It doesn't matter how high an aspiration a baby has, they have to learn certain things before they can do other things. That's just the way it goes, right? That's the way it's been set up. And that in those apparently, those seemingly small things, like, you know, just like standing on two legs. I mean, what is that anyway? Right? Crazy. And when you watch a baby trying to do that, it's like, you know, it's like, oh yeah, that's like a big deal. And how much is riding on that? Right? How much is in just that? You know, finding your balance. And so, you know, to really appreciate like all of that we're learning at every step along the way that cannot be ignored. And at the same time that we're really focusing on this moment that we understand, which is mind as Buddha. So that's why he says in the commentary, if you understand it, then you realize you're wearing Buddha clothes, eating Buddha food, speaking Buddha words, living Buddha life. You know, and this is an extremely, we might say, indulgent, sort of dangerous commentary of Master Wu Men, right? Because it's so easy to feel good about that, and it's okay to feel good about it, right? But like that's enough. I mean, what does that actually mean, right? So of course, the conclusion is, okay, I'm Buddha. But, you know, so is everything different now? So what does that mean? The purpose of that is really to bring the student right back to mind as Buddha. How is that so? So we might imagine, oh, the enlightened mind, the mind that I don't have, the mind that I'm going to have one day. That's not what he's saying. He's saying, mind is Buddha. He's saying, don't pick the mind. Or he's saying, whatever mind you pick, mind is Buddha. It's that vast. It's as fine as a grain of sand, and it's as vast as the boundless sky. And within that is mind and body and breath and heart and emotion and intellect and not knowing. We within this mind, there is no opposition. And it's the source of all opposition. There is no conflict. And it's where every conflict is born. The way is perfect like vast space. No excess, no lack. Mind is Buddha. And so that's why Zazen really is the practice of profound trust in not doing. That we are creatures of doing. We do stuff. We do stuff with our thoughts. We do stuff with our words. We do stuff with our body. We build worlds. We destroy worlds. We write books and operas. We create slogans of tyranny. We create things and we destroy things. Light and dark, good and evil. Where does all this come from? How can all of that be mind is Buddha? In the commentary, he speaks about that well-known story of Master Matsu, who was one day sitting Zazen. And his teacher came up and says, "What are you doing?" And he says, "I'm practicing Zazen." He said, "Why?" He says, "I want to become a Buddha." And so his teacher went over and picked up a brick and started polishing it with a cloth. And Matsu looked over and says, "What are you doing, Master?" He says, "I'm polishing this brick. I'm going to make a mirror." And he says, "You can't do that. You can't make a mirror polishing a brick." He says, "You can't become a Buddha sitting Zazen." He said, "You practice Zazen and try to become a Buddha by sitting. If you want to learn how to do Zazen, if you want to actually do Zazen, know that Zen is not in sitting or lying down. Buddha is not in sitting or lying down. If you want to become a Buddha by sitting, know that Buddha has no fixed form." Never discriminate in living in the Dharma of non-attachment. If you try to become a Buddha by sitting, you're killing the Buddha. If you attach to the form of sitting, you cannot attain Buddhahood. The path of not grasping. But within the path of not grasping, that's not just another activity. It's the profound doing of not doing. And within that, there is seeing. That's why Master Churi said, stop and see. It's not just a kind of mechanical, you know, just put it on automatic. Just don't grasp, just don't grasp, just don't grasp. While I continue to, like, I don't know, surf the internet. It's seeing vividly, brightly, and letting that mind continue to be developed within you, because we have such a strong inclination to go to sleep, to become dull, to become complacent, to not see. It's just a strong habit, but it's a habit. And so in the beginning of practice, it can be like, you know, climbing a mountain backwards on your hands, on your fingertips, in mud. It's hard. Right, it can seem like there's so much energy, right, to just stay aware. How could this ever become natural? How could this ever be my natural mind? It shouldn't take so much work if it's not my natural mind. But that's just not really appreciating and understanding the power of this conditioned mind, right, of our attachments. That's why traditional Buddhism says, look, this isn't just something you've been up to in this lifetime. You've been working on this forever, creating these patterns. That's why they're so strong. Nobody could create such strong, deep conditioned patterns in one lifetime. However we see it, what's in front of us is what we have to practice. That's why it's so difficult to do this on our own. Right? That's why practicing together is so important. That's why sitting with a teacher is so important, because we will return to what we know. That's what we do. And that's while you are sincere and you are trying your best and you're doing it to the best of your ability, and you will return to what you know. It's not your fault. It's not because you're doing something wrong. It's what we do. We will stay within our patterns without even knowing it. We will stay within our patterns without even seeing a pattern. And so we have to be, there have to be ways of facing what we cannot see, right? And that's why I feel like this, the studying patriarchy, the studying racism, sexism is such indispensable Dharma practice. It's not just because it's the practice of our time, and it's not just because it is the karma of our nation, although that's true, but as practitioners, it is because it will give us some of the most important, valuable, powerful training we could possibly encounter. We were having a meeting after this Dharma in Action Day that we did at the monastery. Some folks, a group who have been helping to organize this, and we sent out a survey, and people were, you know, saying what issues they'd like to engage in. And the Beyond Fear of Differences was like one of the, you know, the most interest. And I thought and then said, yeah, that's until we get started. Yeah, and particularly as white folks. And then when your ass is getting kicked and handed back to you, and we're being humbled and disturbed and made angry and finding our defensiveness. In other words, when we're being confronted with the depth of our brainwashing, basically, and the way that, how the depth in, that we, that has been integrated in our being and that we do not know, and it is not who we want to be, and it's not how we want to see ourselves. Our identity. Who am I? Right. How am I in this world? And I think, but if we can recognize that pain and that defensiveness and that, no, I'm not that person. That's not who I am. That's, you know, it's defensiveness and it's, you know, not wanting to take responsibility, but at another level, it's wanting to be somebody who isn't hurting other people. It's wanting to be somebody who isn't part of oppression, who isn't contributing to other people's pain. If we can connect with that, that there's something good, something essential in that, then it can help us. But it's difficult to do this on. I would say impossible. And it's not just my opinion. I would say impossible to do this on our own. We can't do it on our own. We have to do it together. We have to do it in the world. We have to do it in the midst of those things that are going to show us this mind. Right? And not mind in some abstract, you know, Dharma cloak way. But in a way that's nasty, dirty, sharp, right? And that's not all it is, of course. But those are the things that we find so challenging. And why would we do that, right? Why would we stay in such a state of disequilibrium? Why would we allow ourselves to be so disturbed? Because we want to stop suffering. And hopefully that is also awakening in us the desire to truly not want to be causing other suffering. And that those become more and more unified, more and more in alignment. And so that even in those moments where I might indulge or be lazy with my own bias. Like, wake up and it's like, you know what? I just don't want to deal with this today. I don't want to think about this. I don't want to have to read another article. I don't want to have to go to another meeting and confront this. Right? And as a white guy, I could choose that. Right? That's what privilege means. But then I remember that there are people everywhere who can't make that choice. And that helps to inspire me to not be lazy. It inspires me to do that which I recognize, you know, that desire for indulgence, but I cannot indulge that. I cannot be lazy. And we have to do that with other people. In the Perfection of Wisdom Sutra, the Buddha says, whatever gift you give, make sure that that you're giving equally to all beings, and that when you've given that gift, that you turn that over to the Supreme Enlightenment. And what he's saying is that when you do something that creates positive karma, don't just keep that. In other words, continue the gift by offering whatever you have created in that action to others. And you do that in your mind. That's what we do all the time in our services and our liturgy. May all sentient beings realize the Buddha way together. And that when you develop your patience, he says, if you don't do that, your faculties will go to pieces. You won't acquire that body and mind of Buddha. Right? When you become lazy, he says, and don't develop the path, when you don't exert vigor, how can you fulfill the Buddha Dharma? We can't. How can you gain wisdom? How can you cultivate compassion? Can't. If I give myself over to distracted thoughts, he says, then you can't train, right? You can't develop your natural mind of concentration, which opens the door into your inner chamber, which is a metaphor. And of course, that's its power, right? Is to create a sense of, I want to do that. I want, whatever that is, I want to go into that place, right? Because I've been living here a long time, right? And I know I have to make it work here, right? But I need access to some place I haven't been before. Dogen calls that the inner chamber. A fine day under the blue sky. Don't foolishly look here and there. Right? Don't look for another day, another time, more energy, having had a better night's sleep, not having that pain in your leg. Don't look for that. In other words, don't turn away from what you have. In this very moment, what is it that appears before you? That's the only place you can practice. That's the only place you can practice. That's the only path. That's the path to no regret. That's the path to joy. No one has ever found serenity by rejecting that which is before us. And then he says, if you still ask what is Buddha, it's like pleading your innocence while you're holding the stolen goods, right? It reminds me of the story of a master who went into the toilet one late at night, and it was dark, and he bumped into another student, a monk, and he grabbed him and said, gotcha! And the monk says, no, master, it's not me. And he says, it is you. You just won't own up to it. Since that's what we're being challenged to do, is to own up to it. Mind is Buddha, this mind. Living a Buddha life, this life. Facing a Buddha world, this world. How can that be? To see what it is and to be able to tolerate that and also to see what else it is. So let's practice this. Mind is Buddha. In every moment, the moment you would turn away from, the mind that you would reject, the thought stream, right, that you can't seem to let go of, this very mind is Buddha, right? Not to figure something out, but just to bring that in that moment. This very mind is the mind of awakening. Just remember, remember, remember.
Thanks so much for listening. For meditation supplies such as meditation cushions, incense, malas, liturgical instruments, books, and more, visit the Monastery Store at monasterystore.org. Support for your spiritual practice at home.